You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey everyone, Chris Lopez here, and welcome to our first webinar in our three-part series on setting up and structuring business entities when it comes to real estate. Now, I'm a real estate agent here in Denver. I work with Yourcast Real Estate, and I focus on helping people buy investments, mostly rental properties and house hack properties. And it almost always comes up where people say, hey, should I put my property in LLC? What type of entity should I use? What do I need to do for legal protection, tax protection? There's all this big can of worms here, which, you know, I am not a lawyer, and I know enough to say, yeah, that's not a great thing to be thinking about, but you need to talk to an expert. So part of what I like to do here is bring on experts in their respective field to come talk about what they do well and to share some knowledge. That way you and myself including go out there and get the very high level basic knowledge. And when you go talk to the professional or another professional, you've got that very basic understanding. So you get that foundational education. So what we're doing in this one is a three-part series on business entities. And if you're watching the recording, hopefully watch these sequentially. So one, two, three, as they will build on top of each other, going from beginner to more advanced. And my guest and expert is Peter McFarland, who is a partner and attorney at the Business Innovation Group. Peter, you are no stranger to the podcast, but glad to have you back, man. How are you?
I'm great. I'm glad to be back. This is a lot of fun and it gets me out of the office, which is an added bonus. But mainly, I'm here to talk about actually my favorite practice area, which is business entities. We spoke a lot in weeks past about taxes and tax planning, which admittedly gets a little dry. Business entities also admittedly could be a little dry, but I think this is a little bit more fun because really here we're talking about, I guess, more like protecting assets and maybe more, just more approachable legal concepts than, you know, what does the tax code say about this and all of this complicated explanation. So I personally, I'm really excited to talk about business entities instead.
Cool. Well, let's dive in this because I know me and the listeners, we have questions.
Yeah. Well, I'm more than happy to take those. So as you mentioned, partner at Long Law Group, which is the sister company and law firm to Business Innovation Group. Business Innovation Group provides advisory services. You know, as much as I love talking about myself and building myself up and giving you the rundown of who I am, I wouldn't be anything without my team, right? And so that's what I'm trying to get by with this slide is like, look, you know, I'm backed up by a lot of other professionals and really here, overview of really everything that we do, business advisory and planning, revenue and profit improvement, cash flow analysis and forecasting. We do tax planning and preparation, bookkeeping, business entities, executive development, and real estate strategy and planning. So quite a bit. But really what that means and kind of the nutshell view of that is just, look, you know, we're a one-stop shop as much as we can be for kind of the back end of real estate investing, right? Certainly you want to work with Chris to, you know, find your deals and plan and come up with a lot of your strategy. But on the back end, then we can help with a lot of the bookkeeping and a lot of the compliance.
Yeah, the not fun stuff from my point of view.
That's, exactly. Yeah. Back to the idea of, okay, we're talking about maybe some boring stuff today or before. But it's necessary stuff because what we're really talking about is really one of your biggest line item expenses, right? Which is either your liability to the government or liability to somebody who's going to sue you. And really, that's a really good segue into this slide, which is why would you incorporate or why would you organize? Why would you even look at creating a company, right? Well, to me, it really comes back to the potential of who's going to knock on your door. You can have the IRS contact you and say, hey, you know, we got your return and we're not all that pleased. Let's take a look at what's going on here. You can also get the knock on your door from a process server. In the case of rentals, maybe a tenant slipped and fell or something like that. And so now we're going to wind up with somebody suing you. So the reason that you would look to incorporate or organize is number one, to decrease your audit risk, if at all possible, decrease the likelihood that the IRS is going to audit and come knock on your door, or decrease the likelihood that somebody's actually going to come to you and say, hey, I hurt myself and let's see how deep your pockets are.
So did I hear you right that, you know, putting my business into an entity that decreases the risk of an audit?
Yeah, correct. Yep.
Really?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, if you look at the number of returns that the IRS selects for audit, and here I'm talking about just what I like to call the audit lottery, which is really just the chance that you are randomly selected, right? If you take a very aggressive stance on your return, like say you decide that you're going to take $1 million, you're going to amend your original return, which didn't take this original position, then suddenly you amend the return, take $1 million, say research and development tax credit or something like that that you didn't take before. The IRS may come and look at that, and the structuring that I'm talking about here is probably not going to decrease the likelihood of that audit, because clearly just on its face, it's kind of like, wait, what happened here? Why is this so different, right? But if you just look at the numbers and just look at purely randomly what the IRS is selecting for audit, if you are reporting on your 1040, and so that would be Schedule C for real estate agents, or Schedule C or D, depending on the frequency, for fix and flippers, or Schedule E for rentals, if you're just reporting on your 1040, your risk of audit goes way up. So hopefully that answers that question, Chris.
It does. That was interesting.
Yeah. So the other kind of thing that I would point out is this idea between simplicity versus what I call quote unquote asset protection, right? Anytime that I advise clients, there may be reasons that we want to complicate things, and there may be legitimate reasons why we might look at something that's kind of like on the right hand side of this screen here, where you have the trust and the family limited partnership and all these other entities. But by and large, I don't recommend structures like these, because the thing is you're just going to wind up spending all of your time running that structure rather than actually going out and doing what you want to do and what you actually excel at, right? And so typically I'll advise people to move more towards what's on the left-hand side of this slide and try to get them into more of a simple structure. And I think a simple structure run really well still provides great protection, it provides all of the tax advantages, but there's no need to kind of overcomplicate things.
So it kind of goes, one of my life and business mottos is the KISS principle, the keep it simple, stupid principle. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like for this, even in doing the legal entity setup, the keep it simple, stupid is kind of usually the best route, just from a high level standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even if there are legitimate reasons to push more towards the right-hand side of that slide and do something a little bit more complicated, I actually find that 2 or 3 years down the line, we're having the same discussions again about how can we actually just simplify it, right? And I've actually made a really nice living uncomplicating structures. People go to maybe like a seminar or something. There's some promoter there. We'll set up, this really complicated structure. And like 2 years later, then they're in my office saying, I can't run this structure. I have no idea what owns what. And so we kind of wind up moving towards the left anyways, right? And so like I'm saying, there may be legitimate reasons you're over there on the right-hand side, but by and large, keep it simple. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And then a quick word about taxation. I'm not going to dive too deep into taxation today. We'll, from a really high level, talk about, why I might select one type of taxation for an entity over another. But really, we recorded some other webinars really specific to tax. And, I definitely recommend you check those out. But here with LLCs, LLCs can actually be taxed any number of ways. So LLCs were created, and they're kind of a creature of like 1991, 1992. It kind of depends on what state you're in. But the tax code was drafted in 1986, right? And so disregarded entity, partnership, S-corp, and C-corp, all of those are, like categories of taxation that comes out of that 1986 tax code. And when LLCs showed up like 6 years later in 1992, Congress didn't just rewrite the tax code. What they did is say, okay, if you create an LLC, come to us and tell us in these existing categories how you want to be taxed. So I'm missing an arrow here, but the LLC can actually be taxed as a disregarded entity, a partnership, an S-corp, or a C-corp, and compare that to a corporation where it can only be taxed as an S-corp or a C-corp, it's very flexible, right? So today I might be talking about like, oh, you might want to set up like an S-corporation if you're looking at doing whatever activity, but really you can substitute that out and say, okay, you can set up an LLC taxed as an S-corp, right? Because if I'm talking about the taxation piece, really the LLC, if it elects to be treated as any of these particular categories, is identical to, say, an S-corporation or a C-corporation.
Okay.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I've got some questions, but I want to save them. I think you might get into them in future slides.
Okay. All right, more to come. And if I don't get there, then...
Oh, I'll ask. Yeah, I got my notes here.
Please do, yeah. I'm going to make some recommendations around rentals and maybe how you would structure. I went back, Chris, to our slides from before, and I'm pretty sure that the taxation piece of this actually overlaps with what I called like taxes 201. So definitely look for that webinar if you're interested more in the taxation piece. We can go over it, you know, from a high level here. But again, we're really, I think, talking more just specifically about the entities today. So I just, you know, want to be respectful of everybody's time and kind of try to stay to that topic as much as possible. But either way, this is a really great approach. And this is kind of from that first slide of a way to approach rentals, right? What I recommend you do is you set up a master LLC. That master LLC is going to be a multi-member LLC, so you would own it with another person. The biggest question I get asked there is like, well, is a spouse okay? And absolutely, yeah, we can set it up so you own it with your spouse or a brother or a sister or somebody close to you, right?
Why a multi-member?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And the reason is because here in Colorado, we have an adverse bankruptcy ruling coming out of the bankruptcy court downtown. Basically, in that case, a single member LLC held like 5 or 6 properties around here in the Denver area, right? And the single owner of that LLC declared bankruptcy. And so the issue at play was the bankruptcy judge deciding, well, are we going to uphold the asset protection of that single member LLC, even though it only has the one member and that one member declared bankruptcy, right? And in that case, the bankruptcy judge decided, no, we're actually not going to recognize the asset protection of that LLC. And he pierced through the LLC and force the LLC to sell its real estate holdings and make the bankruptcy creditors whole, right? So that's a really troubling ruling for us because if you do find yourself in trouble, a lot of people say, well, I'll never declare bankruptcy. Well, you know, maybe you'll never get yourself in a financial area where, you know, you have to declare bankruptcy. But if you get sued and you have a very large judgment against you because of some tort claim, like somebody slipped and fell at your property, you might actually look at declaring bankruptcy.
Yeah, I mean, hope for the best, plan for the worst.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And so that multi-member LLC kind of sidesteps that bankruptcy ruling to like kind of tie it all back, right? And having that multi-member LLC in place is much stronger for asset protection.
So even, I'm going to ask you 2 scenarios on here. So, yeah. You know, my wife and I, we're partners in a master LLC, and then me and my old business partner, Jason, we're in a multi-member LLC. So if my wife and I were married, I declare bankruptcy, that generally, I'm not sure how the bankruptcy can do it individually if it's a married, you know, venture. Does that help protect the LLC versus me declaring bankruptcy with my former business partner, Jason, who is not, you know, I'm not married with?
Yeah. Now, I am by no means a bankruptcy attorney, and I should absolutely make that clear. I don't have a real clear sense for how bankruptcy really works in different scenarios. All that I know is that we have this bankruptcy ruling, and as a result, really trying to get away from that single member LLC is a really good idea.
Okay.
So I don't know that it's always going to hold up in bankruptcy court, and I certainly can't say, but the idea is that we're throwing up arguments and kind of giving ammunition to the attorney who's going to represent you to potentially be able to make a stronger case for you, right? But aside from that, a lot of LLC operating agreements are drafted in such a way that they have these things called involuntary withdrawals. And so basically, people exiting out of companies happen all the time. And there are kind of 2 scenarios you can look at. One is what we call kind of a voluntary withdrawal, which would be basically you just throwing up your hands and saying, you know what, I'm done, you know, buy me out, right?
Yeah.
I'm tired of this and buy me out. And so, you know, the operating agreement will have specific provisions in there about what we do if that's the scenario. How do we value your interest? Is it, you know, 90 days and I have to pay, you know, pay to basically buy you out, right? Or is it going to be like a promissory note over 5 years, or how does that work, right? Then there's involuntary withdrawals, and with involuntary withdrawals are oftentimes bankruptcy, death, disability, you know, basically those scenarios where you would really still like to be a member of the LLC, but just circumstances have come up where you really just can't, right? What would happen if you're going with just a real kind of vanilla boilerplate operating agreement, what would happen if you declared bankruptcy is you would have an involuntary withdrawal. the other member would be forced to buy your ownership interest, right? And then whatever money you get from that ownership interest would then become part of that bankruptcy estate. And the idea behind doing it that way is actually to keep the company as much as possible out of bankruptcy and keep it preserved and kind of intact as much as possible for the other member who did not declare bankruptcy.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of weird because there's a totally different protection in there, but you can see where it's that multi-member LLC. It's kind of a different scenario because, you know, in the case of like us being in business together, if I declare bankruptcy, Chris, you didn't do anything wrong, right? And like, you're not going through bankruptcy. And so your interest should be protected. It shouldn't be, you know, basically liquidated or whatever, just because I'm declaring bankruptcy.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas if it's that single member LLC, there's really no reason to go down that line of thinking, right? It's like, well, if it's all my LLC, it's really just a legal fiction, the fact that you created this LLC. So we're just going to pierce through that and sell off the property and make your creditors whole, right? That's how that judge was thinking that day. It's funny because that bankruptcy case, actually, a lot of practitioners here in Colorado take that to just basically say, oh, I'm never using a single member LLC, right? It's like single member LLCs are just done in Colorado. And, you know, I don't really take that approach. I think a more mature reading of that case would say two things. First off, we're doing what we call reverse veil piercing, which is really, I wish I had a slide on this. Visually, it would make a lot more sense. But if you kind of envision somebody, if you drew a line through that master LLC oval there and then kind of drew a line going down to sub LLC 2, right? If you kind of view it that way, that's what reverse veil piercing is. It's like they're trying to go through your company structure via you personally to reach assets of your company structure to make them whole, right? And so in that reverse veil piercing scenario, this bankruptcy case is really troubling. But in the traditional scenario, which would be kind of more traditional veil piercing, where you reverse the direction of that line, and basically somebody's trying to go through sub LLC 2 through through the master LLC and back to your personal assets, kind of going the other direction in terms of their veil piercing. That is a much different scenario. And the bankruptcy case probably doesn't apply in that case because we're kind of switching the direction that we're trying to go.
That makes sense. And I'm just realizing that we got a lot of people that'll be listening to this in the future in the podcast. So the slide for this simple entity structuring has a master LLC kind of at the top of the triangle and then three sub LLCs below it. And the master LLC is basically the sole owner of each sub LLC. And then the person or the partnerships are the owners of the master LLC above that pyramid.
Correct. Yeah.
Or triangle, whatever you want to call it.
So for reference moving forward, do you have listeners who like aren't going to see it visually?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
So then I'll try to explain them as we go then. That's, yeah, I listen to a lot of podcasts in the car. So totally get it. Yeah. Yeah. Great. Yeah. So, I mean, creating that master LLC is a really great idea because your asset protection is going to be stronger. But what this does is it actually walks the line between stronger asset protection because of this multi-member master LLC, and then also being really streamlined come tax season. Because as Chris mentioned, there's four companies at play here. We have a master LLC, and then we have three sub LLCs. Each sub LLC being 100% owned by that master LLC, it means that those sub LLCs don't actually have to file a tax return. The master LLC can file a tax return for the whole structure.
Oh.
Right. So here we're looking at four companies, but we're only looking at one tax return, right? But also stronger asset protection because that master LLC has two members.
Yeah. Right? So I got a question here from Matt. He says, can I change a current existing LLC from a single member to a multi-member LLC?
Yeah, absolutely, Matt. You can. There's no filing with the Secretary of State or anything like that that needs to happen. We're in a really great jurisdiction in the sense that the Secretary of State really doesn't ask a lot of questions about what you're doing or who's your member or, you know, anything like that. So you don't have to worry about that. But I would update any internal documents you have, operating agreement, you know, create a resolution kind of explaining what you're doing. And then the IRS needs to be aware of the change because, you know, kind of the nuanced point here that I was kind of getting into, but we're still maybe dancing around, is that a single member LLC can be considered a disregarded entity. And that means that it does not need to file a tax return, right? So if currently your LLC is a disregarded entity, the IRS really doesn't care or may not even know that this LLC exists, right? As soon as you add a partner, by operation of law, you actually default to a partnership. And so you have to file Form 1065. Now, in this scenario, in the rental scenario, the Form 1065, the partnership return is actually what I recommend for the master LLC. We don't have to plan around self-employment tax or anything like that. We don't have to complicate things. Just a simple partnership return will work just fine. But Matt, to get further back to your question, somebody has to notify the IRS of the change, right? And basically say, hey, you know, there's this company, this is the EIN, this is the person who's the responsible party. And by the way, effective this, you know, such and such date, we've switched the taxation and now expect that partnership return moving forward, right? That way, everything on the back end with them is set up so that way you can e-file and all of that.
Great. Thank you. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And just to verify, this is for rental property structuring, right?
Yes, okay. Yeah, rental property structuring. That's absolutely what I recommend. So for self-employment, I'm going to make some recommendations here. Now, this kind of coincides with Tax 301 because it was a little more difficult.
Yeah, we went down a rabbit's hole on that one, on like self-employment income, which I enjoyed and hopefully like three other people enjoyed it as well. Well,
you can count me among the three. I actually had a lot of fun that day. But yeah, that was, we went far afield. It was fun. But at any rate, here, what I'd recommend is an S corporation. And Chris, every time I bring this up, you have definitely some thoughts about this. And so I do, you know, we should explore that because it's the flip side of my recommendation, which is really good. You know, it's funny, my paralegal and I actually today were talking about dissenting voices and kind of how important that is, right? Because you actually get the conversation out there, you know? Yeah. And so that's really good. But at any rate, what I'm indicating on this slide is I have in the right-hand side of the slide, this same structure that I had before, the master LLC, the sub LLCs. The idea being that you may want to set this up in addition to this other structure. The tax strategy is so different that if you're doing rentals and anything that generates self-employment tax, create both of these structures, right?
And these are parallel to each other. One does not own the other one.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. Completely separate. Now, they'll be parallel up and until you own it. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it'll have the common ownership with you. But aside from that, absolutely. I'm talking completely separate. And the reason is because that tax strategy is just so different.
So let me just clarify this for myself. Uh-huh. So I'll just use myself, for example. So I'm a real estate agent and also a real estate investor. So I play the self-employed game. So as the agent, I should probably set up an S corporation for my self-employed stuff. But then as the rental property zone, I set up that master LLC structure with sub LLCs for each rental property.
Right.
And then I'm the common owner at the top of the triangle. I own the S Corp directly. Then I own the master LLC directly.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. The master LLC, I'd throw in that second owner. So maybe your wife or, you know, whoever else. But aside from that, you've got it exactly right. So self-employment tax, right? Anything that has to do with self-employment tax, I'm going to recommend we at least take a look at an S corporation. And I'll explain why in a little bit. But for those listening in the car, on one side, I've got the master LLC and the sub LLC, the same structure I had before. On the left-hand side, I've got just an S corporation. And what I'm talking about with self-employment tax is basically anything where you work for yourself. And so the IRS uses a lot of examples. The best example I can give you is like a guy working in the garage fixing radios. He does maybe one every week, makes $150 every weekend. And the question is he self-employed? And the answer is yes, because he's in business firms himself and he is earning money. And even though it's like this super part-time gig and, you know, he's his own boss and whatever, it's just out of his garage, he's still generating income that's subject to self-employment. So apply that to the real estate investing context, right? Anybody doing rehabs, fix and flips, you're going to have self-employment tax exposure. Anything that begins to look like inventory rather than a capital asset, land by itself is normally a capital asset, but if it crosses the line into more of your inventory, that's a problem. So if you're doing a lot of raw land deals, right, that actually could generate self-employment tax. If you're doing wholesaling, also could generate self-employment tax. And so really anything other than rentals here, I'm talking about the potential that you may want to run that through an S corporation.
So got a question I missed from Joe a few minutes ago. He said for each of the rental property or each of the, wait, for the rental purpose example, does each sub LLC represent a different property?
Yes. Great question and great point. This is a sliding scale for every single one of my clients. And so basically, if you are the most risk adverse, then each sub LLC will have one property each in them. The reason being that really any properties that are grouped together in the same LLC, if somebody sues that LLC, is probably easy for them to get, well, it is easy for them to get the equity that's in that LLC. So if you have three properties in the same LLC, the equity in those three properties is probably up for grabs if somebody's harmed at one of those properties in that LLC. So the most risk adverse of my clients will put one property in each LLC. But at a certain point, that becomes maybe a little difficult because, you know, you have so many properties, right? And so other people may look at it in terms of dollar figures or equity that's built up, and they may say, well, I'm going to try my best to keep it to around 300,000 of equity in each sub LLC, right?
Regardless of the number of properties, they just have more of an equity target.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. And so they may take out like HELOCs or other things to try to equity strip to get down to their goal, you know, kind of figuring like, okay, if I lose 300,000, that's a really bad day, but you know, I haven't lost everything that way. Right. And so you could kind of put a dollar figure to it if you can. The other way to look at it too is also doors, right? And so I wouldn't necessarily put like a triplex with a duplex within one sub LLC because that's five potential doors that are going to sue you. And if there's a family in each unit, right, that's maybe 20 people who potentially could get hurt at your property, right? And so you could look at it kind of any number of ways, but at the end of the day, it's always going to come back to you and kind of your risk tolerance and what you're willing to put into the same basket.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, really good question. I'm glad you brought that up. So yeah, so here with entity structuring, you know, again, anything with that self-employment tax, really looking at putting the S corporation in play here. But as I mentioned, Chris has definite thoughts about this. And the reason is because of what I'm going to talk about here. The reason that we look at creating an S corporation is because when you run income through an S corporation, you pay yourself two ways. You pay yourself a reasonable salary and you pay yourself a shareholder distribution. The reason that that's important is because the reasonable salary has self-employment tax on it. The shareholder distribution does not. So the more you can kind of shove into the shareholder distribution category, the more money you're going to save, because absent the S corporation, 100% of that income would have self-employment tax due on it. And this slide was absolutely kind of included in the prior webinars. And I don't know how much we want to dig into this right now.
Yeah, but, I don't think we will, just because we talked that in detail in the other one. So make sure you listen. I think it was that tax 301 or 301. Yeah, it was the third series in that tax one we did. So go on that. We spent like 40 minutes talking about this. So check out that one.
Yes.
And I'll put a link in there if you guys can't find it in the future recording notes.
Yeah, that's, yeah, absolutely. But dollar figures, I'm always really, you know, just show me what it actually does, right? This is what it does. If you ran it through a sole proprietor, a single member LLC, where 100% of that income was subject to self-employment tax, that's what $100,000 looks like. You wind up paying about $50,300 in tax. That's a lot of money. It's really demotivating. But if you run it through the S corporation, and heck, just even do a 50-50 split between distribution and wages, you save about $7,650 by running it as an S corporation instead. This does not take into account like the new 199A deduction or things like that, but it gives you a sense kind of for what this does and why it's important or why it would be a planning tip. So the flip side of this...
Sorry, before you do, I got one question here. So if you do an LLC... but taxed as an S corp, are you able to do the distributions through that?
Yes.
Model? Okay. So you kind of get the same reasonable salary and dividend distribution through the LLC taxed as S corp versus just a true S corp.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And that's going back to that idea that the LLCs are kind of that product of 1992, right? About 6 years after the tax code. And so an LLC taxed as an S corp is identical for tax purposes to an S corp, right? So it basically the IRS, if they come audit, they don't care that it's an LLC. You know, they're just treating it exactly like it's an S corp, if that makes sense.
So and let me, sorry, I see a question here from Matt. He says, what ratio do you recommend for reasonable salary to distribution? We won't answer that today because that's one of the things we spent like 20 minutes talking about in the other webinar at detail. So check out that and send me an email later if you can't find it.
Yeah. Yeah. Cliff's notes. We don't do a percentage. There's actually a whole kind of framework you have to step through. So definitely look at that other webinar. But, you know, the flip side of this, you know, so the S corporation looks really great, right? You're going to save $7,650 in tax. You're still going to pay $42,650, which is demotivating to me. But at any rate, you know, this saves real money. The flip side of this, though, right, is that you are paying wages. And when you pay wages, that means that you have to partner with a payroll company. You have to file quarterly 941s. There's quarterly filings with the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment. So there's headache and hassle and really even cost associated with doing this. And so for a lot of my clients, there's a tipping point where it makes sense. We want to see a certain amount of income running through the company before we actually make the election to be an S corp, because I don't want to generate more headache and hassle than tax savings.
Yeah, and I mean, I've done that in the past where I've filed that stuff myself, and there are mistakes made. And I mean, I remember I have multiple memories of, you know, there's a $22 discrepancy or tax bill I get, and then 4 hours later on the phone with whatever state I'm in trying to figure it out, I get the $22 thing resolved, which is not quite worth my 4 hours time, but you got to resolve it. Otherwise, you keep getting penalized and taxed, and it just will, and eventually, you know, cost me $1 million in 10 years or something.
Right.
Maybe not quite that bad, but
the flip side,
there's a pain
is,
point there.
Yeah. I mean, there is a pain point there. And I try to be sensitive to that, because for a lot of my clients, you know, there are some who are like, I don't want to pay a single dime more to the IRS than I need to, right? And well, okay, then that pain point is going to be different than somebody like you, Chris, right? And the flip side of that is just work with a payroll company, you know, offload that headache. And if you do get that $20 notice, well, it's somebody else's problem, you know?
Yeah.
But further to that point, if you're going to pay the payroll company, have enough income that you're generating that it actually makes sense.
Yeah, and I can give you guys some recent figures, because I've got I only have one S corp now. That's for my previous businesses. And for years, if you have a business checking account with Bank of America, you get their Intuit, or I think it's Intuit payroll, for free. But they do only partial of your filing taxes for the state you're in. But if you upgrade to, like, I think it's $30 a month I pay now, they do all the filings and paperwork for you. So you have to go in there and click around. But they generate the forms, do all that stuff. And for me, it's well worth it, $30 a month. Now, if you got multiple employees, that's a different ballgame, but it's just it's me and my old business partner in there. So it's a very different, simpler ballgame.
Yeah. Yeah. And for the vast majority of real estate investors, it doesn't need to be complicated, right? There's no need to go down that road. So, you know, I've been dancing between new content and old content here, but part of that is because really we need to get kind of the full picture when we're talking about this stuff. So, you know, I apologize if some of that's review to people who have been listening, and particularly with the tax piece, but now we're going to move on to what I view as really just new content, right?
One question.
Yeah.
Lynette says, hey, Peter and Chris, are properties within entities owned by either self-directed IRAs or traditional and Roth solo Ks either exempt or less pierceable than a non-retirement property owned in an LLC? If so, how much of a difference does it make? Well, Matt, I think you made Peter's day.
Yeah. It's amazing to me what you run into and kind of like what walks through the door, you know, because you see the same structures kind of again and again, but then there are different ways that they play out, or different questions or pain points that kind of go along with them. And this is actually, I think in all the time I've been doing this, the first time I've been asked this particular question, this particular wrinkle, and it's a really good wrinkle. It's really cool. So, you know, the starting point, I'm actually going to take a small detour before answering the question itself. The starting point is that, you know, a lot of people do own real estate using their retirement plans. You can absolutely do like a self-directed IRA, a solo Roth 401, you know, whatever it may be. And then that entity itself can actually own real estate. A lot of people assume right off the bat that that entity or that that retirement plan doesn't need to file a tax return, and that's actually not always the case. You can have what's called unrelated business income tax, and that basically arises from your IRA or your 401 unfairly competing with other businesses. And so that you see that where like an IRA is doing fix and flips rather than rentals, right? Rental income being that passive income, kind of similar to what you would get in terms of like dividends or interest on the stock market. That's different than like actively going out there and generating like income that would be subject to self-employment tax, right? So where your IRA is kind of competing with other businesses, that's where this tax is levied. And so it would have to file a 990T. And pay tax at trust rates. The other way that you see it is what's called UDFI, which is unrelated debt financed income. And that's much more common in the rental scenario where maybe your IRA only puts down 20% of the purchase price and you take out financing for the remainder of the cost of the rental. The rental income that you're getting back is actually taxed at a proportion because part of it's leveraged. Right. And so there you also have to file a 990T and pay tax at the trust rates. So so it kind of depends. It's like if your IRA or your retirement plan can purchase the property outright and you're just renting it, no problems. Right. It's really straightforward. But if you get into other scenarios, not as straightforward. But the question didn't have to do with taxation at all. And I just kind of wanted to take that detour because it's worth talking about because I don't think a lot of people know about that. But with asset protection in particular, you're kind of in an interesting position because most of the retirement plan structures are set up so that the retirement plan owns the owns an LLC and it's a sole member of that LLC. And the reason you do that is to set up checkbook control, right? That way you don't always have to go back to your custodian and, you know, always get a check cut for 15 or 20 bucks a pop, whatever it is. And so this way you can be the manager of the LLC, your IRA or your 401 owns it. And then you have checkbook control. You can do what you need to do. But it being a single member LLC, the question is, well, oh, you know, are we kind of in that single member LLC bankruptcy area? You know, what about the single member LLC being a little bit weaker? And, you know, that is a legitimate concern. It's a legitimate worry. But retirement plans under Colorado law are actually protected kind of on their own. And so even me as an individual, if I declared bankruptcy, my retirement plan would be safe to a certain extent. And that's because the Colorado legislature realizes that people need money to retire, right? And so we each of us have kind of these things called state exemptions. For instance, your house has another one. It's called the homestead exemption, right? And then your retirement plan has another one. Now, I don't know offhand what the retirement plan exemption is in Colorado. It's probably not enough to save your entire retirement plan. And it's probably, if we looked at it, it's probably really low. Almost laughably low, but there would be a certain dollar figure that would be unreachable by your creditors because it's just protected by operation of law. So, you know, is the single member LLC and retirement plan kind of structure a problem or is it more or less protected? You know, it's probably, I would say, equally protected. It's just protected in a different way. Right. And then they'd have to kind of make all of the arguments to say, well, I need to pierce through this single member LLC, which, again, is not the reverse veil piercing that we were looking at in that bankruptcy case. And then even then, they'd have to roll back to the retirement plan and then make arguments to get around the exemptions and things like that. So it's just a different beast. But I would say, you know, the flip side of that is that there's no other way to do it. Right. If you want your retirement plan to invest in real estate, you know, the only other option would be to have it partner with another retirement plan or find another legitimate partner.
So we got a follow-up question on there. And
you may have to punt on this just for time restrictions, but does rolling a traditional IRA into a solo K eliminate the UDFI and UBIT taxes?
Yeah, 401s have a different rule when it comes to UBIT and UDFI. So I will punt on the specifics about that. Typically, though, 401s have a better treatment under those rules. So that's something that you should look at doing.
Yeah. So basically, like, it can be friendlier with those taxes in mind.
Correct.
Okay, yeah. Perfect.
Yeah. Great questions. All right. So it's funny because anytime we go down the retirement plan route, it's always just like it's a wormhole all of its own. But at any rate, compliance. So here I'm talking about how to keep your entity in compliance, right? So you've formed it. What do you need to look at year after year? Here in Colorado, we're actually very lucky in the sense that the Secretary of State, they don't, as I mentioned, they don't really seem to care about, you know, what you're doing or who's members in your company or anything like that. And they also don't seem to care much about filing fees. And so here in Colorado, it's $10 every single year. You have to file your periodic report every single year. It basically updates the information that's on file with the Secretary of State, and then you pay $10, and that's pretty much all you need to do with them. So the initial filing with them is $50, but then year after year, it's $10.
That is dirt cheap.
Isn't it?
Like, I've lived in other states, and there's at least one more zero behind those numbers.
Oh, easy. Yeah. And a lot of people, they'll go and get, I actually don't have a slide on this, but this is a really good discussion. We should bring it up maybe later, is where do you organize or where do you incorporate, right? And a lot of people go to a promoter or whatever, and they get sold on the idea, say, of like a Nevada LLC, right? And there's some reasons you may want to be in Nevada, but all the same, it's funny because like Nevada, I think on its own is about $400 a year. It's $100, I think, for the periodic filing. But then you also have to do your, it's like a list of officers and business license, and that's $300 right there. So, you know, just kind of comparing, it's like, well, do you want to spend $400 year after year to be in Nevada or just $10 in Colorado? I mean, the answer is pretty clear to me.
And I had Corporations Nevada, and that sounds about right. It was much more expensive than these Colorado prices.
Yeah. So Colorado's cheap. It's really great. I have a bunch of companies formed that I'm actually not doing anything with, but you know, I don't ever shut them down because it's also just so cheap to just keep filing year after year.
Because it's
so,
$10 a year, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, one day I'll put those companies to good use. But at any rate, then, you know, you also have your tax returns, right? And so we talked a little bit about what that looks like. For rentals, again, the partnership return, really the best approach, Form 1060. You have a C corporation option, which would be 1120, S corporation 1120S. The disregarded entity can flow back to whoever owns it. So that could be any number of those returns. And then if you are that S corporation or the C corporation, you're going to cut wages. And so you're looking at the 941s and the 940s. There may be state and local filings as well. Like I talked about the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment. By and large, local governments don't really levy a tax here in Colorado. But if you're doing sales, like for instance, I just set up a chocolate company. And then before that, I set up an ice cream company, which it sounds oddly specific in like the food industry. I haven't marketed at all towards any of that. But either way, they have a lot of local sales, right? And so we had to look at local sales tax. Tax licensing.
And so let me ask you before we move on to entity structuring, going back to slides ago where you had like the master LLC, then owning, you know, three sub LLCs, and you're saying, hey, great, you only need to basically file one tax return for that master LLC.
Right.
So generally speaking, like, I'm assuming there's got to be some tax prep, and I'm pointing to sub LLC one, number two, number three. Uh-huh. There's got to be additional tax prep there for the tax preparer. But at the end of the day, you're only filing one tax return, but four annual filing fees.
Yeah, so
I can ask you like three questions there, but
I totally follow.
Okay,
yeah. So I'm back on the entity structuring slide where we're looking at like the approach for fix and flips as well as the rentals, and so we have that structure with the master LLC and the sub LLCs, and then we also have the S corp. On this slide, even though we have five companies, we're only looking at two tax returns because the master LLC is going to file a partnership return, and then the S corporation will file the 1120S, the S corporation return. So two tax returns. Chris, you're right. On a bookkeeping level, Sub LLC 1 should have its own books, right? Sub LLC 2 should have its own books. Sub LLC should have its own books. And the reason is so that way we can look specifically at that company and see what its profit and loss looks like. And,
yeah.
And you know, but mechanically, if you're using like QuickBooks, for instance, it all could be set up under the master LLC, but you could track your assets by class, right? And so you could even do it property by property. And really you want to nail down with that type of specificity anyways, because you want to look at your investment, right? And you want to look at how it's performing and you want to budget and you want to make projections and figure out if it's actually performing well for you, right? And so having that level of granularity is actually already something that's a really great idea. Everybody should be doing it. But yeah, for bookkeeping purposes, it's a little more complicated because we're going to get it down in these sub LLCs. But from a tax return perspective, easy because we're keeping it at the master level. And even though I say it's more difficult from a bookkeeping perspective, I actually don't really buy that either because you're going to have to keep those books anyways.
Yeah, it's just the category, basically.
Exactly. It's just kind of how you approach it. So
okay.
Hopefully that answers that question.
Yeah.
Or those three questions. Cool. So, you know, keeping this in compliance, and that should say entity compliance at the top of this slide. But at any rate, you know, everybody asks me about meetings and minutes, right? It seems really formulaic and it seems really dumb to do, particularly if it's a single member LLC, right? Or maybe an LLC with you and your spouse. But really, it still is something that you should do. What we're trying to do, just as kind of a large explanation, a high level explanation, is make an argument that the company is a separate and distinct legal entity from you, right? The more that it looks like it's just you with like a $50 filing to the Secretary of State, the less protection you're going to get, right? So the more formality you can have and the more that this looks like a separate and distinct legal entity, the more protection you're going to have. And meetings and minutes are one of the ways that you can do this and get a lot of really good ammunition to use in the courtroom, right? So it's important to have at least one annual meeting where you talk about maybe the finances of the company, how was the performance last year? If you're in rentals, for instance, maybe talk about, okay, the levels of your rent, is it still competitive? Do you need to raise rent, lower it, you know, whatever. Look at the last tax return, talk about depreciation, maybe a cost seg study, something like that. But the more formal you can make these meeting minutes, really the better, because then, you know, if you go into the courtroom and you say, okay, judge, I've filed with the Secretary of State, here's my articles of organization, year after year, I have my periodic reports, here's 10 years of meeting minutes, right? That looks really formal. That looks really good, rather than going in and just saying, okay, judge, I paid my $50 to the Secretary of State, I should be protected. And the question is why, right? So you just want to run that business in a business-like manner, right? That's really what we're driving at here. So it feels really silly, but do it. And, you know, if you need to entice yourself by going out to a nice steak dinner or something like that, you know, do that. So the other thing that you want to do is not commingle your bank accounts. Here, just for everybody kind of in the car or wherever you may be, we're looking kind of at the same rental structure that I've been talking about, which is a master LLC and then the sub LLCs and properties in them. And what I'm doing is tracing the flow of money going in and out of the company, right? And so on the right-hand side of the slide, we're looking at rent being paid in. And what I want is for rent to be paid to the sub LLC, then for the sub LLC to transfer the money back to the master LLC, and then for the master LLC to transfer out to the owners, right? And the reason that I want to do that is to avoid this argument that the funds have been commingled, right? Commingling just basically means that there's no division about how you put the money in. And you know, what we want to do is really create like a clean paper trail showing exactly where the rent went. And we want to have every company involved as the owner of the other company, et cetera, back out to you as the owners, right? And then the same holds true for the left-hand side of the slide, which is if you need to contribute capital for any reason into the company, great. You know, you contribute into the master LLC, then the master LLC contributes to the sub, and then the sub incurs the expense and actually does what it needs to do at the property.
So I want to ask you, a somewhat related question to here, because you know, I've had multiple corporations over the years, and you know, some have been, some have not been. I'll say like, you know, real. I don't say real business, but business with a lot of transactions. Where I've got, you know, merchant accounts where I've got 5, 10, 15 deposits happening and going or coming every day. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, cool. It's basically like pay a credit card bill once a month, and maybe deposit a check or write a check every now and then.
Uh-huh.
And so I've often used, and I'm curious if this is right or not, just like, great, I've got, you know, 5 personal credit cards. So I said, hey, great, personal credit card 1 is for this LLC I have. And then to avoid the headache, hassle, expense of opening a business checking account, which often has, you know, a $5,000 or $10,000 minimum balance to avoid a $30 a month fee, I'm like, well, I don't need to keep $10,000 a month in there. I've just set up like another checking account at my personal Bank of America or personal Ally. But it's, you know, it's in my mind and on paper, it's dedicated to that entity. So I've got my personal credit card mm-hmm. dedicated to LLC one and my a new personal checking account dedicated to LLC one. And I keep a clean paper trail like this where I deposit and write checks like that. But since those are personal checking accounts and credit cards, is that a major issue? Maybe, maybe not.
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on who's knocking on your door, right?
Okay.
If the IRS comes knocking on your door and they're looking to audit, it's probably not a big deal because your books are set up cleanly, right? And the chart of accounts is set up in such a way that, like, it would be really impossible to know that, for instance, your Ally account isn't an Ally business account, right? I don't think they offer business accounts, but...
Well, yeah, they don't. So.
Yeah, but the fact that, like, you know, from a bookkeeping perspective, all of the deposits in there are income and all of the expenses in there are presumably business expenses.
Like, correct.
You know, there's not really an audit problem there, right? From an asset protection perspective, though, you've commingled your personal finances with your business, right?
So that would count as commingling then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, well, yeah, it's not as bad, say, as like using the same account for personal and business expenditures. That's the worst. That's what we absolutely want to avoid, right? The fact that it's dedicated to the company is a really good fact in your favor. And, you know, a lot of my clients ask me this because, especially with related to credit lines, companies that are like brand new, you know,
you can't get a credit card.
Right. Exactly. You just can't get a credit card. So if you absolutely have to do this, and a lot of people do, you know, do exactly as Chris says, just dedicate it to business use. But then what I would do is go back to your meeting minutes and memorialize why you're doing it, right?
Oh.
And then what you've done is not only created like a nice little barrier in case you do get sued, but also you've created like more formality for the company, which is even more protection against the potential lawsuit, right? So if you're going to do that, you know, the strict like legal answer probably is, well, your personal is commingled with your business. But I think the way to dance around it is to then explain why you're doing it and create formality around it and then really dedicate it just to that business use.
Okay. Right? And I've always thought about it more in these past businesses, more from just the tax audit standpoint, because other businesses, they were, you know, I don't want to jinx myself, but just extremely low liability, nothing like doing real estate and rentals. It was mostly like online marketing stuff. So very, very little risk there. So I didn't think about it from the asset protection standpoint.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, that marketing, you know, is one of those red hot, you know, industries where, you know, people get sued. I'm completely joking with you, Chris.
Yeah, that's not funny, Peter.
Yeah. No, it's not like holding a rental, right? I mean, a rental or, you know, like fix and flips where there's exposed wires and people going up and down ladders and that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, real estate can be a little risky, right? In terms of we kind of call them like red hot assets, right? They're not like a stock on the stock market, right? So, you know, we've talked a little bit about businesses and keeping them in compliance and everything else. I mean, the next thing to talk about here is just, well, how do you take it to the next level, right? Because it's funny, I have this new perspective, and 2019 has been kind of a year of this where I've said, you know, what did I used to advise clients and is that really enough? And a lot of people, they do this with tax preparation, I think the most often, is they'll get like fairly clean books, file their tax returns, and then pat themselves on the back and say, job well done, right? Or in this case, they'll set up an LLC, they'll pay $50 to the Secretary of State, not do anything else, and pat themselves on a job well done. Well, you know, fill it out, create your operating agreement, create your minutes, get a business bank account, right? Like actually fill it all out to the point where it really is this existing and separate legal entity. But then from there, don't pat yourself on the back yet. Take it to the next level, right? Go to what is, you know, really important. So I say 6 pillars, really 4 pillars to bigger success here. here. Proper entity structuring and compliance. Well, we've talked about that. If you follow all those steps and kind of keep an eye to everything I've talked about there, you're going to be done with that. But then let's talk about good bookkeeping, financial analysis, tax planning, right? Your numbers are the way that your business speaks to you, right? And so really good bookkeeping is really important. On a Saturday morning, do you want to be looking at the pile that's there on the left, or do you want to be looking at, you know, something way more fun and something that you may want to do? I actually don't do yoga, Chris, but, you know, I'd rather do yoga than bookkeeping, right? And full disclosure, I'm not a bookkeeper. I have a bookkeeper in the office because I don't want to do it. But at any rate, you should look at having good bookkeeping, right? Now, if you are competent and you can do this, great, go for it. But again, a lot of people, just to offload the headache, it's worth it. But why do you want to do good bookkeeping? You want to go beyond the P&L and balance sheet. P&L is profit and loss statement, and balance sheet is your balance sheet. That's what you need at a bare minimum for tax preparation, right? But if you have really good bookkeeping, you can go even further. You can create a budget. You can stay organized. You can make informed decisions. You can ease reporting. So not only just tax reporting, but if you're looking for investors, having really good books is like, it's not even step one. It's step like ground floor, right? Like your investors need to see where you're at and what your numbers look like. And so easing that reporting is a really important piece of that. You can track profit and growth with good bookkeeping. You can increase your cash flow. You can get snapshots at any point of where your business is at. And more importantly, you can focus on strategy. You can actually look at, where am I going? How am I going to grow this? How am I going to scale this? So bookkeeping is really important, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not in agreement here, because that's something I've always been a big proponent of. And I mean, for, you know, most myself and a lot of the people on the webinar, like it's pretty simple to do. Like I do it for a couple different businesses every month, and it takes me from about 20 minutes an hour every month, because great, you have four different credit cards, download statement, categorize. You have a software that anytime you want to run a report on how much did I spend the last 3 months, or my quarterly P&L, or for this line item, how much did I spend this year? So if you mouse clicks and the reporting is done, like it's phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so easy with software and whatever apps are out there now.
Absolutely, yeah. And the financial analysis, I think, is actually the really fun part of this. And so I just wanted to show you kind of some of the reports that we've generated for clients with really good bookkeeping, right? So here we're looking, these are real reports that I actually did generate for clients. I blocked out their names with a white text box, so you can't see who they are. But at any rate, here, this is a real client of mine, you know, their top 10 non-payroll expenses. Just to be able to see that in a graph form, right, is really telling, right? Contract labor, of course, they were fix and flippers, so that made sense. But, you know, they had a lot of other things in there. Their advertising and promotion, for instance, their internet was like through the roof. And so just looking at that, we were kind of thinking, and why, right?
Well, they're fix and flippers. They gotta generate leads.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but 16% to me was, that was a talking point at any rate. And then a lot of travel expenses too, right? And so kind of hammering into that. Anyways, it's just, you know, good bookkeeping. I mean, if you're just doing like an Excel spreadsheet or something, it's really hard to see it this clearly, right? And so good bookkeeping, I think, is again, a really big deal. How much money are you making on your investment? This is return on capital employed, right? And so we can actually map it out and see what that looks like for this particular client. How much profit are you making from your operations? And is your current revenue growing? We can see the percentage as well as dollar figures here. We didn't enter September numbers, which is why everything like goes to complete crap in September. but otherwise, you know, pretty, there's a story to tell there. And then income comparison year over year. This was 2017 to 2018. But, you know, again, just sometimes seeing these numbers and seeing the trends and the graphs and things can really, it can be telling, right? And if you have all of those in place and you can begin to look at that, then you can look at effective tax planning as well. This is a real tax plan that we generated for a client. This one was about 65 pages or so, and we ended up saving them about $62,000 in tax. That's not going to be year over year, because some of the strategies were pretty big, kind of one-time off things. But again, you know, really good tax planning, this is one of your biggest line items, right? And so to be able to generate, number one, those kind of savings, but then have savings year over year, the tax plan certainly pays for itself. But at any rate, it's just something that really good bookkeeping, again, having those clean numbers and having your company speak to you in a language that everybody can understand is really important. So I'm not going to get much more into tax strategies in particular. I included some just in case we're struggling for time. But if you're interested in more tax planning, go check out the slides from before. It's an hour long webinar, right, Chris?
I think we went to like an hour and a half plus on some of those.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Yeah, on the tax ones.
We went detailed.
Yeah, but I'm trying to be considerate of people's time today. And,
Yeah. Now, if you got more stuff, we can go on or we can.
Well, I mean, this is just kind of a call to action that's maybe beyond a little bit what we thought we were talking about today. But I mean, proper entity and structuring and compliance is like, it's step one, right? I mean, but consider some of the value added that you can add to that, right? And kind of the fact that the bookkeeping grows out of the entity structuring and compliance, but then other things can grow out of that as well, right? So with that, I'm going to open it up. Chris, do we have more questions?
I've got some more questions, but before I dive in all those, what's the brief? What are we talking about on the next two webinars, just so I don't put the cart before the horse?
Yeah.
Do you remember the, I'm asking, I don't know if you remember the descriptions, but we're going to talk, we're diving more into these, right?
Let me pull that up, Chris. Yeah. But in the meantime, if you
I can pull them up over here. I've got my computer turned
fair
on.
Enough,
Now I'll read them here. That way people know what's coming up. So business entities 201, LLC or partnership, which is better, exploring the liability veil, how to approach multiple rentals, duplexes, triplexes, and larger portfolios. So I'm assuming that will be talking more about the master LLC and sub LLC structures.
Yeah. So I now that I'm seeing that, I seem to recall, and just so you guys know, Chris and I set up these descriptions like back in
months ago,
like March maybe or something. So we're going back quite a ways. But at any rate, Business Entities 201, I think seeing this description again, the idea is that we're going to really nail down into more things related to rentals, right? And then Business Entities 301, the idea behind that being a little more, I guess, advanced, is that we're going to look at much more the corporation side of things, C corporations and S corporations, and when you might look at creating those. So if you're generating that self-employment tax, right, if you're outside the realm of rentals, or if for some reason you're interested in fringe benefits or medical benefits or things like that, that maybe you can integrate into your structure, that's going to be more that Business Entity 301.
Good. And we're going to be talking about the 199A deduction, which I still don't understand. So I'm glad we'll be talking about that in episode three.
See, I can't do one without sneaking in the other. We're going to get some tax discussion.
They overlap. I mean, the two reasons you do a corporation is for liability and tax purposes. I don't know why else. I'm missing something else.
No. No, Chris, you're exactly right. It's always the parallel considerations is what I always tell people. And you have asset protection on the one side and tax planning on the other. And so what I do and what I'm trying to do is kind of go through the triage with any particular visitor or client and just figure out, well, where do those two meet and what's the best strategy, right?
So one question, you know, many, many slides ago, we talked about having like your S-corp for your self-employment side, you know, your active business, whether you're an agent, a flipper, a wholesaler, or something else that's an active, you know, business job in real estate, and then a separate structure with your LLC entities, the master sub-LLCs for the rental portfolio, more of the passive hands-off investing. Does it ever make sense to mix the two? I'm an agent. I've got investments. Should I have a S-corp own all that or an LLC and all? Does it ever make sense to combine the two?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's going to come back, I guess, to kind of the sliding scales again, right?
Okay.
And so I would say that the industry standard and kind of where my, like, for lack of a better term, my lawyer sense, when it begins to like tingle, kind of like Spider-Man or something like that, like when all of a sudden something in the back of my head's kind of like, I don't know about this. That goes off when we lump everything together. The reason is because from an asset protection perspective, having everything in the same basket is really risky, right? And so if you as an agent get sued, suddenly all of your rentals are part of that lawsuit. Right. Or if somebody slips and falls, your stream of income from your agent activity suddenly becomes subject to that lawsuit. Right.
Okay. So that makes sense. So it's just generally speaking, it's just best to keep things separate.
Right.
Okay.
The other piece of that is a trick with the S corporation is that if you move property into the S corporation and then later have to move it back out, you actually trigger a sale on the asset. So the way we see this most often is somebody got bad advice from a CPA that said, just put it all in an S corporation. They've held rentals for 10 years in that S corporation. Suddenly they want to do a cash out refi. And the lender says, oh, no big deal. Just retitle it in your personal name and then title it back to the LLC or the corporation. Well, as soon as you transfer the property out of the corporation to your personal name, you've triggered a sale, right? And if you've held that for 10 years, you're looking at pretty significant long-term capital gains that you have to come up with the funds elsewhere for, because you're probably not going to want to sell that piece of property to pay the tax on it, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So you kind of have like phantom income there, right? And so that's a real problem with S corporations in particular. So like if you're looking at, you know, lumping everything together, you're just starting out and you just want to keep things simple or whatever, you might run it all through like a partnership or something like that, a partnership or a single member LLC, just to keep things simple, but err on the side of not being in that S corp, and then, you know, later maybe creating that S corp and spinning things out appropriately.
And kind of a random question here, but if I own rentals in an S corp, well, then I still have to have the rent. So if I own all my rental properties in S corp, and that the rental properties bring an income, I still have to pay myself a reasonable salary out of that income then, right? Or can it be a complete pass-through? Because it seems like, and this might be a totally off-the-wall question, but then now I'm taking investment income and inadvertently turning into self-employment income, right? Potentially?
Yes.
Or should we just nix this question?
No. Okay. I mean, no, it's a fine question. I don't think you're going to have to pay yourself the salary off of that. And the reason is because it's this passive income and it's going to come out on the K-1 appropriately to be entered into the 10. So the K-1, just so everybody knows, is the schedule that comes off of the S corporation return that has all of the information that you need to prepare your 1040, right? Because it's a flow through entity, Everything winds up back on your 1040. So the fact that it's this passive rental income means that when it shows up on that K-1, it's going to be correctly like coded or whatever, so that it doesn't wind up generating the self-employment tax, and not only self-employment tax, but also the need to actually pay the salary. And when the IRS looks at the return, that all makes sense because of the way that it's entered. It's a little complicated, but suffice to say, no, if it's purely just rentals, I don't think you need to cut the salary. But at any rate, backing up a little bit, there are issues with like S corporations only earning passive income year after year after year. And it has to do, you have to be careful of accumulated earnings and profits and other things where potentially your S corporation, the S election actually terminates and then you wind up reverting back to a C corp. It's really rare when this happens. It's typically not something that people have to worry about, but there are circumstances where it can happen. So holding just rentals and just passive income in an S corporation, somebody needs to do an analysis on that and just make sure you're not going to run into bigger issues.
Okay.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, stick rentals and LLC is the punchline.
LLC as partnership. Yep.
Great. Well... Looking at the questions, that was the last one. So everyone, thank you for watching out or tuning in and watching this. We'll be having the future ones in the next couple of weeks. If you're listening to a future recording, check the show notes and there'll be links to all three of these recordings as well. Some of our goals here is to make this some solid educational content that we and future people can come back and reference, get that very basic education. Then when you go meet with Peter or your lawyer, you've got a solid education component, so we can have a much more productive conversation when you sit down to meet. So Peter, thank you for your time. It's always greatly appreciated.
Yeah, thank you.